city of Sacramento passed a bilateral Gaza ceasefire resolution late last night after hours of passionate public comment. Ahead on Insight, two of the voices behind the resolution join us, Mayor Daryl Steinberg and Bassem El-Khara with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Also, artificial intelligence, it's here, and California is embracing its benefits as well as weighing the risks. The California Department of Technology joins us about how the state is looking to harness the power of AI, from emergency response to enhancing the California experience. Finally, two El Dorado County women are putting five decades of river adventures into a new book. We'll learn about a river called home. It is a love letter to the American river, as well as a testament to the power of friendship. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. But first, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Last night, the Sacramento City Council approved a bilateral Gaza ceasefire resolution following weeks of protests and passionate public comment at City Council meetings. In a vote of 6-1, just before midnight, the ceasefire resolution was approved and it was a packed house. It followed hours of public comment last night, and some arrests were made by Sacramento police for disobeying orders to disperse the chamber during a recess. The lone council member to vote no was Lisa Kaplan, and Councilmember Myvang was absent due to a previously scheduled family commitment. But the city ceasefire resolution last night wasn't the first option. Nearly 2 months ago, council members Katie Valenzuela and Myvang introduced a resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire, but it was blocked by Mayor Steinberg, calling it far too one-sided and would further inflame tensions in our community. Last night's ceasefire resolution was called a principled compromise. It was crafted among the Jewish, Muslim, and Palestinian leaders here in Sacramento. Joining us is Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who is Jewish, as well as Bassem El-Khara, a Palestinian-American and executive director of the Sacramento Valley chapter of the Council of American-Islamic Relations, also known as CARE. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us, Vicky.
Thank you, Vicky.
I want to lead with having a night to sleep on it, not even really a night. I mean, the council meeting went until pretty much midnight, and I'm sure it was an early morning for both of you. There wasn't an empty seat in the House last night. There were hours of public comment. There were also, as I mentioned, some arrests for not dispersing the chamber during recess. I mean, that really just captures a lot of pain, a lot of fear, a lot of anguish. The emotions were heavy and were intense at times last night. I get that the resolution passed, but given that this is so deeply personal for each of you, overall, do you view last night as a success, Mayor Steinberg?
I do. As painful and difficult as last night was, as painful and difficult as the war in Israel and Gaza is, as painful as the breakdown of longstanding friendships and interfaith relationships in our community has been, I believe last night represented some progress. To have Jewish community leaders and Muslim and Palestinian American leaders standing together in support of an imperfect resolution, but a resolution that really attempted to acknowledge the pain and the perspectives of all communities, I think it was the right thing to do. I'm pleased with the end result, and I do think that it can represent the beginning of what motivated me in the first place, and that is to create conversation and rebuild friendship and relationship that have been damaged over these last number of months.
Bassem, having some hours to reflect on this, what was the big message you got from last night's meeting?
I mean, now the whole country knows that Sacramento, the capital of California, the most powerful state in the most powerful country, has come out for a permanent ceasefire. And I think that sends a message. And when we join the hundreds of cities around the country that have come out for a ceasefire, and this just increases the pressure on the federal government to listen to the people. The polling has shown that the majority of Americans of all backgrounds want a ceasefire. And at the end of the day, this conflict is being fueled by American money and weaponry, and we're complicit in what's happening in Gaza. So I think it was huge. And it was a victory for the community. Nothing's perfect, but I think it really, the mayor worked his hardest behind the scenes to get us to the finish line, to bring the communities together. And at the end of the day, the message is Sacramento stands for a permanent ceasefire.
Sacramento has also had long interfaith relations in the city and in the community. I have been to events where both of you are standing side by side, but this time has been trying, and we've had those conversations on Insight. I mean, has there been a time in the past where it having a resolution like this, having conversations like this, making compromise like this, have you ever had to embark upon this before in Sacramento?
Not exactly in this way, because as I said last night, we have always found reasons to stand with and for each other when one of us has been the victims of discrimination and prejudice. This is different because there is a war, and it and the fact that Bassem and I, Bassem is my friend, can sit here together and talk about what we did together while disagreeing on some things here. I mean, the parts of the resolution that created discomfort and frankly a lot of the outbursts from young people was the acknowledgement that while all the violence has to end, that's bilateral ceasefire, the suffering of the people in Gaza needs to end, humanitarian relief is essential. The resolution also said that Hamas committed a horrific atrocity on October 7th and that a safe and secure Israel is important as an antidote to the increase in anti-Semitism. And these are the truths held by, I think, the majority of our community who believe in a two-state solution. There are a lot of young people who disagreed, and I think they're ill-informed. And yet the center, I think, held last night. And the fact that we can sit together here and acknowledge each other's pain and truth and try to lead the entire community to a better place, that's worth it. And you better believe it calls for a bilateral ceasefire. That's the right thing to do because we want to see the ending of violence and the return of the hostages. And we want to see that immediately. That's what most Americans want.
Bassem?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the last two decades I've been here in Sacramento, we work very closely with our Jewish allies, especially our progressive Jewish allies, Jewish Voice for Peace, and others who've been standing side by side with us through the thick and thin, through all the challenges we faced since 9/11, you know, during the Trump era. And so last night was a display of that, where a lot of these folks came together to push for a ceasefire. Now, what was interesting about last night is that looked at the online comments, and 56% supported a ceasefire resolution. 25.4% supported ceasefire resolution with amendments, and then 18.5% opposed it. And then in public comments yesterday, it was clear that, you know, the majority supported with amendments. And I think, so, you know, and some amendments were included. And so I think, you know, everyone was heard. Everyone, you know, made clear where they stand on issues. And at the end, like I said, at the end of the day, nationally, what folks are going to pay attention to is that Sacramento is on record coming for a permanent ceasefire. And the mayor did it in a way to try to bring folks together. And it wasn't easy. And it was, you know, there were challenges along the way, but folks worked hard behind the scenes. There's amazing young ladies who initiated this. And this actually was initiated after there was a city council meeting. Some anti-Semitic comments were made. And then the pro-Palestinian protesters said, we're going to walk out. This is unacceptable. And then the mayor had an exchange with them. And these amazing young ladies, Mekiz, Haya, and Amira, got to work, read all the different ceasefire resolutions from around the country, and they created a draft. And then, you know, since then, it was like back and forth with many key leaders in the community on all sides. Folks looked at the drafts. They said they made suggestions. Look, there's so many folks. I mean, Tawfiq Marar, lucky that we had an attorney also involved. He was really instrumental in helping us get to the finish line. Others looked at it, Dr. Hibba. I mean, the list goes on of so many amazing folks in the community that really worked hard to try to get this to the finish line. At the end, Coastview, which is the Council of Sacramento Valley Islamic Organizations, which is the umbrella of the Muslim community, of all the mosques and organizations, including CARE, came out to support. We saw key leaders there yesterday, and that was powerful. It was powerful to see Muslim leaders, Jewish leaders calling for a ceasefire together.
Mayor Steinberg, I mean, when it comes to both of these communities, they're far from a monolith, obviously. For you, Mayor Steinberg, you have deep ties to the Jewish community here. You did have support among some Jewish leaders, but others did not support this resolution. How do you navigate those conversations within your own community?
Well, not easily, but the conversations are necessary. And, you know, some of my critics may say that this resolution divided the Jewish community. No, it actually exposed the divisions that already exist and within the larger community on these issues. Look, I mean, last night was a perfect microcosm of the challenge. There were some people from the Jewish Federation and others, and I'm disappointed with their position and action, frankly, that said that this resolution was not supportive enough of Israel. And then you had other Jewish community members from the left who said it was far too supportive of Israel. And of course, you had a lot of young people, mostly non-Palestinian and Muslims, frankly, who verged on the edge of anti-Semitism by denouncing Israel and its right to exist. And so this is the dilemma. And so when I have the opportunity to sit down with Abbas Malkara and CARE to try to craft something that I think affirms the need and right of a Jewish state, but also says clearly there needs to be new leadership in Israel. What's controversial about saying that both Netanyahu and Hamas need to go? There won't be peace with Netanyahu, and Hamas needs to go in leadership. I think that you stay with it, you fight for it, you wake up the next morning and you hope that people will start talking to each other in a different way, even if people who are absolutely opposed for different reasons don't quite get that.
Hmm. Bassam, what do you say to people within the Palestinian community here in Sacramento who say this resolution doesn't speak or represent their views?
We respect their views, and I made it clear that I had issues with aspects of the resolution. And it was a negotiation, and in negotiations we don't get everything we want. But we had to move this forward. We had to find a way to get Sacramento on the record to support a permanent ceasefire. And did it take? Was there a compromise? Yes. And there was compromise on all sides, where folks were trying to add language. All sides were trying to add language and change and edit. I mean, it wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy process, but you know, we got to the finish line, and the vote was 6-1, and I think it's now clear we join these major cities around the country, and we just need to stop. You know, we have to stop this genocide. I mean, my family, I mean, every day, you know, you wake up not knowing what news you're going to hear, who was killed, and just the struggles that they're facing every day. We just got pictures a few days ago that our house, part of it was destroyed, it was burnt. And then my grandfather's house, which we always dreamt, you know, his grandchildren always dreamt to make it like a museum, because it was over like 100 years old, past generation and generation, and it was destroyed. And so this, you know, just every day you just don't know what to, it's like a nightmare that never ends. And I know this is symbolic, but being the capital city, this does put pressure on our elected officials, our members of Congress in the region, that, you know, they should listen to the people of Sacramento and that they should work harder to push for a permanent ceasefire.
You know, you touched upon your family, because the last time you joined us, Bassam, was back in December. And I remember back then you shared that at least 20 of your family members had been killed. I mean, you shared a little bit of an update, but can you tell us more about what you know today?
So this is probably from a few weeks ago. The last number was 76 family members that were killed. And these are not killed. They died because of medical condition. The number would be high because we were losing a lot of our elders. And once this is said and done, we're just afraid, because there's many segments of the family we have not been able to communicate with. And so, I mean, you know, a lot of our elders that we always dreamt to go back and visit and record their stories and pass it to our children, they're no longer with us. And so it's a nightmare, and just watching, and this is why there's just so much anger out there, because a lot of these young people, they're on Instagram and they're on TikTok and they're seeing this being recorded and shared with the world from both sides. You're seeing Israeli soldiers share the most sadistic videos, and then you see the victims and children being torn to pieces and pulling children out of rubble every single day, and losing our heroes, our professors, our doctors, our journalists, and it's very targeted. You know, it's very targeted to who's being killed. I mean, the top professors. I mean, and so it's scary. And I don't know how, you know, you try to hold out some hope, you know, that it's one day it'll get better, that this will lead to, you know, to peace and justice. But I don't know how, you know, these children will recover from this nightmare. I mean, the famine-like conditions that are happening right now, this has generational consequences. We see what happened in the subcontinent under British colonialism. The famine there and the famine in Ireland had generational consequences, and that's what we're afraid of.
Mayor Steinberg?
Well, the only thing that I can say to Bossum is I'm so terribly sorry for all of your loss and for all the people in Sacramento who have lost. And that's why calling for a permanent bilateral ceasefire is essential, that the violence needs to stop on all sides. And the dilemma here, and it's not a dilemma to say that for me at all, the struggle in our community is how do we break down what I call the equivalence argument, right? No one's suffering is better or worse or lesser than anybody else's. And so to say in a resolution that over 25,000 innocent people have died in Gaza, and that's terrible and it needs to stop, and at the same time say that over 1,000 Jewish people in Israel were killed in a horrific atrocity, that's wrong too. And the division is really about people having a hard time because of fear and trauma, and sometimes just plain misinformation, not being able or willing to acknowledge the pain and the suffering of the other side. And so this effort, again, was about trying to change that in some small way and to get us to acknowledge each other.
In the last few minutes that we have, I want to get to the first sentence in the resolution, because it says nothing we say or do in Sacramento may change the course of the war for Israel, Gaza, or the West Bank. So overall, Bossum, I know that you mentioned the ceasefire is meant to put pressure on the Biden administration. But for you, Mayor Steinberg, what is the aim of this ceasefire? I mean, if that was the first sentence, knowing that, and some would argue we need to focus on city issues.
Well, first of all, we do focus on city issues. I spend virtually all of my time on economic development, the rail yards, the waterfront, youth, homelessness. That's my job. And this has been a little extra work, but that's fine. I agree that all things being equal, the city council should not be weighing in regularly on international affairs. But this is an exception because this affects so many thousands of Jewish people and Palestinian people and Muslim people in our community. And like it or not, it's been brought to our doorstep every single week. And we are not at war with each other, even though some of the voices are loud and there's a lot of anger. We are not at war with each other. And so the underlying reason for this is very simple. If we can do anything to rebuild the bonds a friendship between our interfaith communities, between Jews, Palestinians, and Muslims in Sacramento, where we have this long and rich history of standing with and for each other, then the pain is worth it. And I hope today and tomorrow and next week that conversations that have not been happening since October 7th begin anew.
Mm. Bossum, do you think those conversations will start? I mean, you know, mentioning how the mayor just said that it's been difficult the past 5 months and counting.
The conversations have been happening, and there's been disagreements, and there's been solidarity, and there's folks checking in on each other. And I think that will continue. And I think, has it strained relations? Absolutely. Yes. You know, there's folks, you know, posting about what's happening over there, and other, you know, other folks getting upset about that. So leaders have, you know, have an opportunity to try to bridge the gaps. And also, look, at the end of the day, for me as a Palestinian and a Muslim, you know, I've been taught by my parents is that you stand with the truth and justice, even if it's against, you know, the Quran says yourself, your tribe, your people. And so we've always been clear that anytime any, you know, Muslim or Palestinian does something that crosses a line or attacks civilians, we've been very clear about that. And we've seen some folks in the community kind of justifying certain things. And that's deeply hurtful to our community. And I think it's going to take time to heal, because there's some folks that we looked at as leaders in our community, and we feel like we've been let down.
Bassem and Mayor Steinberg, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you.
That is Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg and Bassem El-Karo with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, discussing last night's City Council vote on a bilateral Gaza ceasefire resolution. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Artificial intelligence, or AI, it is all around us. From medicine, research, education, sports, even government, AI is starting to have a more profound impact on our daily lives. Here in California, it is our next digital frontier. Governor Newsom recently noted that our state is already home to 35 of the top 50 AI companies in the world. That's why the state of California is taking a deep dive into the benefits of AI, as well as identifying its risks. The state is looking into how the state can harness artificial intelligence to rethink policies, programs, and workforce development, but also while still having some guardrails. While the benefits can be put to good use, there are also concerns, of course, over privacy, equity, safety, just to name a few. Liana Bailey Crimmins is the California's Chief Information Officer and Director of the California Department of Technology. She's really in charge of learning how AI can benefit the state and joins us with more about what her department is working on. Liana, welcome to Insight. Good afternoon.
Well, thank you, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Yeah, pleasure to have you. So these two little words, A and I, they get thrown a lot. They get thrown around a lot, and especially more and more every day. But for people who obviously have heard of AI, but they don't really know all the inner workings of it, can we start off with like a 101? What is artificial intelligence? How do we experience it?
Sure. So technology is the scaffolding that holds up our society. It's where we're using our televisions. I had cancer 5 years ago, and if I didn't have medical technology, I probably wouldn't be here today. So we are experiencing technology through every aspect, even driving here from work, right? And so when we think of artificial intelligence, the state of California has been using it for over a decade. We've been able, through Cal Fire, which is, you know, Alerta California, where we've been able to use predictive analytics, large data sets to be able and looking at cameras and how we can predict smoke and be able to see early indicators of fires. And the first 2 months that Cal Fire had that out there, 77 fires were detected by artificial intelligence before any 911 calls came in. So it shows you that artificial intelligence has been used throughout government. But when we think of generative AI, what's different about that is that it's using algorithms, but it's actually generating content. So it is a form of technology that if it's looking at Renoir or Degas, that it could actually look at paintings and actually create a painting. It can look at who I am on the internet and create a resume. I've done that. I don't know if I would actually submit that to any employer, but it's important to understand that it is trying to fill in the gaps. And so that's why it's very important as society, as we're growing into this whole new generative AI revolution, basically the intelligence revolution, that we're looking at it with a keen eye, but also a keen eye both on the benefit side, but on a keen eye of what potential harms could happen to society if we aren't really focusing on both and in a balanced approach.
So when I think of generative AI, as you explain it, is that like ChatGPT?
That is one. So ChatGPT, Bard. So that's more a public domain. It's more prompt generated. And so you put a prompt and as good as the data is, it comes back with an answer. In fact, I was at a conference yesterday and the person had done a prompt and he was looking at several type of rice cookers. And he kept saying, give me three. And it kept giving him four. I said, are you sure that it's three? And ChatGPT kept saying, yes, it is three. He says, you might want to count again. So ChatGPT is obviously one aspect of it. But what we're seeing in the technology world is that it's being built into a lot of the technology. You're going to see it in Word. You see it in Grammarly. You see it in Teams. So it really is fundamentally a technology that's being built into a lot of our technologies that currently exist. I always say it's not the tool, it's how it's being used. So with government, we have a lot of access to data that the trust of the public instills in us, and we need to make sure that how we're using those tools are in ways that don't amplify or create new risk, and that we don't, we have to be very careful what is publicly and privately available when we make decisions.
You illustrated one example of how AI is being used in a good way by the state with, you know, wildfire mitigation and reducing the risk. I mean, it identified, as you say, over 70 wildfires, and I think that's before anyone even called 911, right? So that seems like a good win, you know, for the state. In what other ways can AI be beneficial? I mean, I know one, which I think would be attractive to a lot of people who have a vehicle, is that it could potentially like ease traffic or improve roadways?
So we do have 5 requests for innovative ideas on the street right now that we're working with the industry. And so we're using publicly available data. I really believe in crawl, walk, and run. And so public available data, Caltrans has 2. One is for vulnerable road users. We know that there are untimely deaths on our roadways. How can we use traffic information to help save lives? And then also, any of us that have driven into work, traffic isn't always the funnest. Can we actually use generative AI to predict and actually help us determine where bottlenecks are, how we can reroute? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to reduce those hour commutes to even less, especially if you work in the Bay Area?
And one solution is also how, I guess, as I say, like how we experience California, how we interact with state departments and agencies. I mean, it can be laborious at best. I mean, how could AI help how we interact with the state when we have to, you know, go to the DMV or go to other agencies?
So DMV is actually using not Gen AI, but artificial intelligence. Miles, the chatbot, if you have.
That's who Miles is.
That's who Miles is. So a lot of us work during the day. It's difficult to get to a DMV. So is there a way after hours to be able to connect with a chatbot that's continual learning from what it's doing really well? And when a customer decides, you didn't answer my question correctly, I'm going to go ahead and talk to a representative, how it's learning. And right now it's got over a 90% success rate, so that people are getting simple information that it needs. It's continually, you know, how can we improve that experience and then allow the agents and the residents to be able to interact with people when it's more complex and they need that guidance. So how can we help workers work faster and more, focus on the things that are more complex? And then again, the whole overall customer experience. And my shout out to DMV, because they are doing continually evolving work that are helping the overall resident get a better experience by the kiosk with their vehicle registration. And you can actually go and start your queue while you're driving to the DMV, so you don't have to wait till you actually get in line.
Oh, so you can wait from home.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Like you do
going.
A restaurant, right?
Right.
You know? Yeah.
So, okay, these are like the perks and the benefits. But of course, I mean, this is also scary. There is also the fear of unintended consequences and harm. So what does accountability look like when it comes to the use of artificial intelligence by the state?
So Governor Newsom, shout out to him, because obviously one of the first governors, but very balanced approach. So in addition, as we're looking at benefits and risk and how you procure, on the other side, we're also looking at critical infrastructure. As we are society looking at ways to use generative AI in a positive way, there are people that are using generative AI in a way that, how do I hack into a system and how do I do something negative? So looking at working with CalSIC and Cal OES and Department of Military and actually Homeland Security, how do we make sure that we protect against those threats? I'm using you know, like type of technologies, but also looking at vulnerable communities. California Department of Technology is responsible for the state digital equity plan. And one in five Californians don't have access to highly available, affordable internet. And we learned through the pandemic that when people went to remote going into remote learning, they were unable to have internet at home in some cases, and so they fell behind. What we have to make sure with vulnerable populations is that we're not creating a bigger gap. How do we use generative AI in a way to reduce and create equity, not amplify or create new? And so working with each department, you know, if you're Cal EPA, you have a different group of people that are looking from a vulnerable population. You may be living next to a waste or a garbage, you know, a garbage plant or something that might be a different vulnerability than if you don't have broadband or if you're someone that is low income and trying to get health care. So how do we make sure that we understand who our vulnerable populations are? How do we use technology? And having that human in the middle, the technology does not get to make the decision. Humans have consciences, they have ethics, and sometimes when the data doesn't look right, we challenge it and we still try to make the best decision on behalf of society. That should not change just because we're using a new technology like generative AI.
Lily, Liana, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, this was only just, you need to come back. Okay. I have a lot more questions.
Sounds good. Because we all see those movies where technology takes over. There is really positive ways that we could be using this. And so thank you, Vicki, and thank you for your listeners.
Liana Bailey-Crimmins is California State Chief Information Officer and Director of the California Department of Technology. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Two El Dorado County women have put over 50 years of river adventures and activism into a new book. The river has been a backdrop of their interconnected lives, from travel to business and even marriage. The two met their husbands on the river. This novella tells the story of four animal friends, bear, eagle, frog, and rabbit, embarking on a rafting trip down the South Fork of the American River. But the story is more than just an adventure tale. It serves as a testament to their love of the river, the power of friendship, and looking deeper into one's own self. Author Maura Magnusson and artist Robin Center are the creative minds behind A River Called Home, A River Fable, and they join us now to talk about how this story came to be. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time and making the trip down Highway 50. So my husband and his family, for generations, they have been river rats. They love rivers and have traveled and guided down rivers for many years and generations. So I have a little sense of why the river can be addicting in a good way. And I'm just curious for both of you, when did your love and appreciation for rivers come to be?
Well, I'll start. I'm Robin, and I grew up on the Merced River in the San Joaquin Valley on a dairy farm, and so I played with my six siblings on the river, floating down to McConnell State Park and digging in its banks, and so grew up with the river around me. And then my sister moved to and went to school at Columbia Junior College near Sonora, and her friend asked her if she wanted to camp out on the banks of the Stanislaus River for that summer, and I joined her there, and that was the first time I was exposed to whitewater rafting and had met different people who then took me down the river, and soon after, I got involved with ETC, Environmental Traveling Companions, and started taking institutionalized people, the Royal Chicano Air Force, group home kids and fell in love with the experience of sharing the canyon, and soon found out that it was threatened by dams, so got involved with Friends of the River. And that's kind of my beginning of river roots, and just loved the river and lived at Chicken Falls for 9 months on the Stanislaus River. So it's deep in my heart.
Yeah, clearly. How about you, Maura?
Likewise, my first introduction to the river was the Stanislaus River. When I was about 15 or 16, I went on a commercial trip when the Stanislaus was undammed and free-flowing, and after immersing myself in the water and swimming in eddies and jumping off of a rope swing into the river, I was smitten, like many people are, and ever since, I've been in love with rivers and have done rivers, rafted rivers, and been a river guide throughout the United States and abroad.
Mm. So the two of you obviously go way back, as well as your love for rivers. When did a novella, a river fable, when did it start taking shape for the both of you?
Well, I belong to a artist co-op gallery on Main Street in Placerville, and just decided having that structure would make it easier for me to be more productive artistically, and came up with a illustration painting of the four friends in a raft, and the frog is just doing the typical, after you shove off from shore, for me as a guide, I would dip into the water and ask for a safe trip and thank the river. And that was the first illustration, and I talked to Maura about it, and she and I just riffed on what this story could unfold to be.
I mean, Robin, your artistry is beautiful. I mean, the watercolors, like, really bring this story to life. Maura, you were the words in this story. How did you create this, you know, going alongside, you know, the beautiful art that Robin put together?
Well, it was a process, and I had some time off between jobs. I had about 8 months off between employment. And so I used that time, Robin and I used that time to create the book. I would, once we sort of fleshed out who these characters were, I began to write the story. And about every week, I would have a chapter, and I would hand the chapter off to Robin. Robin would illustrate it, and then she would come back to me with that illustration. And so it was kind of a do-si-do dance that we did in creating the book.
So the four characters, they're animals. They're all female, eagle, rabbit, frog, and bear. And what I loved about all four of them is that I think we can find a piece of ourselves in each animal, depending at the point in our lives where we're at. The eagle seemed more of like a workaholic, you know, more serious. Rabbit seemed to be a little more overwhelmed, a little agitated, busy. The frog, obviously, just kind of loose and relaxed on the river. Frog is the one that brings the three friends on this trip. And then bear is maternal, a little cautious at the beginning. What went into choosing these animals?
Well, Robin originally came up with the creatures, and then we spoke a little bit about the qualities that you just addressed. But then as I was writing the book and diving deeper into it, I modeled the characters after people I knew in my life. In particular, Frog was based on a friend and woman river guide who I boated with, and she's an international river guide. And so I invested Frog with her qualities that I admired and kind of wished I could be like. I think Rabbit, I didn't know it at the time, but Rabbit was me, anxious, agitated, a little pressed for time. And then we also looked at Eagle in terms of a personal, someone I knew, but also sort of representative on a bigger level of, as you said, kind of a workaholic and obsessed with capital, et cetera, et cetera. And Bear, as you said, maternal, kind. There was several women that we actually based Bear on.
What kind of response have you had to the book? Because I know, you know, people have taken it in. You also had a book signing not too long ago. What are the messages that you've received?
There's been a wonderful response from friends who have bought it for their friends. And one woman who's in a group that we belong in said that it's the first time friends have written her letters back. She said they usually call or text. And in this case, she gave them the book and they wrote her. They were so moved by it. And I've had friends who are, you know, don't have children, a husband and wife in Bend who decided to read the book together before they went to bed and, you know, acted out different characters. And so another person just gave it to her son and his grandchildren, and they read the book together through, you know, once you know the story, you can kind of read it through the pictures. So all different ages seem to have found something that resonates for them about it, which is wonderful.
Yeah, Maura, what is the power of using animals as the main characters as opposed to, you know, for women rafting down the river?
I think that the power lies in that we can more readily identify with the characteristics of the animals, not when they're specific people. So if an animal is objectionable in a way because we have affinity towards animals more than we might with people, or maybe I'm just describing myself, then when we have affinities with animals, we can sort of, we're more open to the qualities that the animals evince. So the animals have lots of frailties, but there's also lots of really wonderful quirks and characteristics that they embody.
Where can people find the book?
Well, it's currently at Camp Lotus and at the River Store and the Sierra Rising Bakery, and then on Main Street in Placerville. There's two, the Placerville News and the Bookery.
But also the website, rivercalledhome.com, is how people can find the book now.
Mm. Oh, and the Bookhouse in Cameron Park. So we are appreciative that these places, we're just beginning to get it out of our trunk and into places that people can see.
That is awesome. And we do have the website on our Insight page too. So if they don't live in El Dorado County or aren't nearby but love rivers, we can connect them to your website. Finally, in the last minute that we have, you know, this is for really all ages. I mean, the audience is broad. How do you hope people feel when they close the book?
I hope that they feel some joy and excitement and want to share it and just appreciate rivers give our lives so much. And I like the idea that people get exposed to how much we need rivers and how important they are.
Yeah, I found it reflective. Yeah. Reflected on, it's easy to get caught up in the daily hustle, you know.
That's exactly it. It feels to me when I reread it and think about it that it's kind of refreshing and is an antidote to the overwhelm that we are experiencing right now. Both rivers are an antidote. If you're on a river, you can't help but feel good, and the book steers you that way as well.
Robin Center and Maura Magnusson are the author and the artist behind the new book, A River Called Home, A River Fable. We do have a link to the book on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.